Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
It's the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, and our producer this morning. The president on Capitol Hill yesterday afternoon, hoping to move things along in the infrastructure debate, but he did not succeed. And actually, when speaking with reporters, got a little testy about the lack of progress. He was asked when he would get it done.
It doesn't matter when. It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done.
Why has it been so challenging to unite the party, Mr. President? Why has it been so challenging to unite the party?
Come on, man. Unite the party, 50-50. I got it.
Yeah, just like you got it on Afghanistan, and just like you've got it on inflation, just like you got it on the border. I could go on. He might also want to consider that if it takes 6 months, that's 6 months more of his poll numbers tanking. So as you are likely aware, the president is facing a huge problem within his own party. Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema and, of course, Joe Manchin of West Virginia have both dug their heels on. They've said no to the $3.5 trillion infrastructure package. Senator Joe Manchin has said it will not exceed $1.5 trillion, so they're a little ways off. As you've also likely seen, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema being courted by the White House and other Democrats, and it's even upsetting Congressman Ro Khanna, the Democrat.
Senator Sinema is being treated like a head of state. I've never requested or met with the president in the Oval Office. I meet with his staff. She meets with him like every other day. She's a first-term senator, and she hasn't put out a framework yet.
That's just one example of the tension within the Democratic Party. We'll talk more on the infrastructure package and next steps, but here on the Saturday Morning Update, we've asked John Gizzi to join us a little bit early this morning. He is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com, and we'll get into the very latest on President Biden on Capitol Hill, the infrastructure package. We'll talk with John about that right after 7 o'clock. But to start off this morning, I need your help in clarifying these definitions of spending packages, of legislation. We're hearing about deficits. We're hearing about the debt. We're hearing about the infrastructure spending. So first off, the difference between the national debt and the deficit.
The deficit is when the government runs in the red after a year's spending. Deficit spending is something that's gone on more years than it hasn't. And that is essentially the interest on the national debt. The national debt, on the other hand, is the aggregate total of all this deficit spending. In other words, spending money that we don't have. The last time I checked the national debt clock, it was 28.6 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars, and it had gone up considerably in just the last 6 weeks. Now, the package that is before Congress is to lift the debt ceiling so we can spend more in the red and keep the government running. The House passed a measure, and Republicans, almost to a member, opposed it because it would keep the debt lifted for nearly a year, something that's very rarely publicized, and that could mean, Republicans say, a lot more deficit spending. It's now gone to the Senate, where Republican senators are going to try to hold it, or at least get it to keeping the government opening for the rest of the year. I might add that Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen said last week that unless the debt ceiling was lifted and more deficit spending permitted, the government would shut down on October 18th. Now, it should be pointed out, these figures are always sooner rather than later figures. The Treasury Department finds some reserve money, some unknown source of revenue, to keep the government open a few more weeks than when they say it will close.
So the next step is the Senate, and the Republicans are saying now that they will not support a debt limit increase. So would that mean a government shutdown? And haven't the Republicans been burned in government shutdowns in the past?
In 1995, during the winter season, the government did shut down, and President Clinton was successfully putting the blame on the new Republican Congress, specifically Speaker Newt Gingrich and many of the Republicans who'd been elected in 1994. Republicans were burnt on that, and then they usually went along with extending the debt ceiling. Senator Ted Cruz managed to stop the extension of the debt ceiling a few years ago because he thought this would stop the funding of the Affordable Care Act. It did not work, and eventually he gave in. Let me tell you, I have covered for years government shutdowns for a few days. I know exactly what happens. The Social Security checks are honored, and the military is paid, and the mail is delivered. And if it were to go for a period of time, then they determine workers who are essential and non-essential in government. And the government would limp along. Eventually, though, as Christine Lagarde said, we would be not living up to our full faith and credit around the world, and that would be economic turmoil.
And we will spend more time with John Gizzi, get the very latest on President Biden's trip over to Capitol Hill yesterday afternoon, which, as we mentioned earlier, was not a smashing success. Wouldn't you think the guy that promised to unite the country could at least unite his own party? I mean, he can't even do that. Could take 6 months. How long have they been working on this? How long has this been the lead story in the news? And he's, 6 minutes, 6 weeks, 6 months, whatever. Okay, that's fine. It is 6:15. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In D.C. right now on 695 eastbound, there is an accident at South Capitol Street, jamming traffic back to the 3rd Street Tunnel. Now on the outer loop of the Beltway in Montgomery County, there's a crash with three right lanes blocked. This is approaching New Hampshire Avenue, jamming traffic back to the 95 interchange. On New Hampshire Avenue, there's a crash in Langley Park right at University Boulevard. In Prince George's County, no delays on the inner loop or on the outer loop, but on the BW Parkway northbound in Beltsville, there's an accident right near Powder Mill Road. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Well, after a delightful end to the week, we are expecting more nice conditions for this weekend. Today will be a little bit warmer, highs in the upper 70s to near 80 degrees under mostly sunny skies. Now, later on tonight, lows back in the 50s across the region. Some increasing clouds as we head towards your Sunday. We're expecting rain chances to be minimal, best chance in the mountains and the Appalachians. I think the D.C. metro will be dry. High temperatures tomorrow in the low and mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
51 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:17 on the Saturday Morning Update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL, and if you think you have pressure in your life during the day, lots of pressure on Capitol Hill. Now, as we've seen, you've got the pressure from the progressive Democrats versus the moderate Democrats. The president's in the middle in all of this. And that's just the Democrat side. Then you have the Republicans pushing back against the president. Factor in now the external pressure that is intensifying on both sides, the AFL-CIO and other labor unions issuing statements in support of immediately taking up the infrastructure bill, grassroots organizations cheering the liberal lawmakers to hold the line and hold out for a reconciliation bill. The Democrats trying to use reconciliation to move the social spending bill, and if that were to work out, the process would allow the Congress to advance certain spending and tax bills on a simple majority vote. And that budget reconciliation process would allow the Congress to potentially pass the sweeping $3.5 trillion social safety net if they could get Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin to support it. Now, Joe Manchin has been firmly entrenched. He called $3.5 trillion fiscal insanity earlier this week. He says his top line is $1.5 trillion, and here's how he expressed it this week.
My top line has been $1.5 because I believe in my heart that what we can do and what the needs we have right now and what we can afford to do without basically changing our whole society to an entitlement mentality.
And he's pretty firm on how he feels about this.
I've never been a liberal in any way, shape, or the form. I'm not asking them to change. I'm willing to come from zero to 1.5.
So we know that AOC and the squad and some members of the progressives have really been going after Joe Manchin. Here's how AOC responded to Senator Manchin.
For 1 year? I mean, here's the thing, is that there's a lot of games being played with this number. Let's be really clear about what the current status is with $3.5 trillion. That's $350 billion per year.
And she continued.
So if this is really about the deficit, then maybe we go after our defense spending and find our savings there instead of going after people's child care.
So that's kind of where things stand on Capitol Hill. A lot of going back and forth. Some of the progressives have talked about possibly understanding that they're going to have to drop down that $3.5 trillion, and we'll have more with John Gizzi coming up on that later this morning. So stick around, because we've got an action-packed show this morning with all of these things going on. So we're glad that you have joined us on the Saturday Morning Update. Some other interesting things are going on in the news, and this one has sort of popped up overnight, and it involves the vice president. Now, as you know, Vice President Harris would be needed on Capitol Hill if the Senate were to do a vote, and if it was tied, she is the tiebreaker. Well, the vice president flew to Southern California yesterday for a quick trip, but the White House is mum about the reason behind it. That's according to reports on the Fox News Channel. The vice president departed yesterday afternoon from Joint Base Andrews, flew to Palm Springs. Now, as you know, Palm Springs, lovely resort town, great golf, about 107 miles east of Los Angeles. The vice president scheduled to return to Washington today, the White House said in a statement, according to the newspaper. So how much jet fuel did that run us so she could zip out there yesterday afternoon and come back today? Was it dinner? Was there maybe a really good yard sale or estate sale this morning? I don't know. Now, Kamala Harris and her husband, Doug Emhoff, own a home in Brentwood. Now, Brentwood, as you may recall, is in Los Angeles. That was kind of the center of attention during the O.J. Simpson mess, because that's where his residence was. Well, the White House said Harris would be spending the night in Palm Springs at an unspecified location. Reporters were not permitted to watch the vice president depart from Andrews. Wow. Can you imagine if Mike Pence or Donald Trump had pulled this? Remember when Trump went to Walter Reed and the whole world fell apart because he went to Walter Reed one afternoon and came right back? And he's out there for a couple hours, and the mystery has continued. Finally revealed, I think, in Grisham's book. It's another joke, but we'll get into that. So very interesting that the vice president can make an unspecified trip to Los Angeles, unidentified, down to Palm Springs. But while she's out that way, she can't stop by the border on the way back. And you do recall that Vice President Harris was out that way campaigning for the California governor, Gavin Newsom, in the San Francisco neighborhood. She went out to help him out. But no telling what the vice president was up to last night. I hope CNN tracks that down for us. 6:23 now on the Saturday Morning Update. 6:26, it is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. One of the other big stories earlier in the week, of course, the hearings on Capitol Hill, the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, the General who is in charge of CENTCOM, Frank McKenzie, and, of course, we had General Mark Milley, and they were all on Capitol Hill. And the big question that a lot of people have had is the president making comments and sticking with them. He started August 24th with George Stephanopoulos and has stuck with this all the way through, that none of the generals were insistent to keep 2,500 troops in Afghanistan, that everybody was fine with his idea to pull all the troops out, like, by the end of August. So he has maintained that story, but a lot of the congressmen and senators on Capitol Hill aren't buying it, including Senator from Louisiana. And this is Mike Johnson, and he's pretty much nailed it here for you. So this is how the testimony laid out, and he asks the question of General McKenzie first and then also of Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. Again, this is Senator Mike Johnson, the Republican of Louisiana.
Either the president lied to the American people, or he legitimately cannot remember the counsel of his top military advisors in winding down the longest war in American history, or you have not been fully accurate under oath. General McKenzie, I'll ask you, which is it?
I'm going to be very direct. I cannot share advice I give the president. And I will not do that. I believe the appropriate level of our forces in Afghanistan should have been 2,500.
What did the president know? Did he forget what was told to him? Or is he not being truthful?
I view that as an inappropriate question, and I won't.
Well, you may, but the American people don't. Yeah. And the American people want and deserve accountability.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator. Great questions. General Jack Keane is a somewhat legendary general, and he has put all of this in perspective. Of course, he's one of the contributors over at the Fox News Channel. Here's how he summed it up.
What I was listening to hear is that the president did hear from them personally. The three people that provided testimony, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of Joint Chiefs, and the Commander of CENTCOM, but also the ground operational commander of our forces and NATO forces, General Miller. They all talked to him, not just about their opposition to the withdrawal, Pete, but what the consequences would be.
Yeah.
And General Miller emphasized that the collapse of the government and the Afghan security forces could go a lot faster than anybody anticipates. So the president had to embrace all of that and still go forward and make this decision, which turned out to be a calamity because now we have a terrorist organization running a country in southern Asia, and it'd be an epicenter for growth of terrorism for sure.
And that's just some of the fireworks on Capitol Hill earlier in the week. We're coming up on 6:30. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. And coming up, we'll talk with Jennifer Harper, some very interesting poll numbers from around the country. Jim Trusty will join us, our legal expert. And this morning we'll be talking with Jim about two of the very strange family cases in the news. And, of course, that is the Gabby Petito-Brian Laundry story. And the Murtaugh family, the attorney in South Carolina. And, boy, that one gets crazier every day. And we'll get the very latest from Jim Trusty on how those are playing out. John Gizzi will join us coming up top of the hour, 7 o'clock. And when we get with John, we're going to ask him more about the infrastructure debate up on Capitol Hill, the Democrats, and where it goes next. Progressives may be bending a little bit, and we'll get the very latest from John on that. Cheryl Atkinson is going to be with us this morning. She's covering some interesting stories, especially when it comes to critical race theory. So that'll be coming up with Cheryl a bit later on this morning. Also, medical tourism. You might be interested in this one. Also, we will talk with a doctor over at the Washington Hospital Center at MedStar. Very interesting developments on the treatment of AFib, and that's coming up. They just had something approved by the FDA that can be very helpful to people suffering from AFib. We'll also be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. And with Tony, we're going to get his read on that testimony at Capitol Hill, because critically important in the accountability on what happened in Afghanistan. So we'll chat with Tony about that this morning. Also, what's the latest with North Korea? And they've been firing missiles again, all quiet under Trump. But now it appears that the North Koreans are getting back into the fireworks business and testing our president on that front. And KT McFarland will join us, and she always puts it in perspective when it comes to the Biden administration and what's next on national security. So stick with us on the Saturday Morning Update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
And atop the headlines this morning, the president has pledged to Capitol Hill to get it done as Democrats strain to rescue a scaled-back version of his $3.5 trillion government overhaul and salvage a related public works bill. But it's not going to get done soon. The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told colleagues in a letter that more time is needed. The president huddling privately on Friday with House Democrats after days of frantic negotiations with no deal. Biden also planning to visit American cities next week to make his case. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia wants to scale back that big bill to $1.5 trillion. That is too meager for progressive lawmakers. California will become the first U.S. state to require COVID-19 vaccinations for children to attend public and private schools in person. That under a mandate that could affect millions of students. Governor Gavin Newsom announcing that yesterday. He says the coronavirus shot will be added to 10 other immunizations already required for school kids, including those for measles and mumps. The United States has reached its latest pandemic milestone, eclipsing 700,000 deaths from COVID-19. COVID-19 infections are down 30% from the beginning of September. North Korea says it has test-fired a new anti-aircraft missile. It is the fourth weapons launch in recent weeks. Experts say it's part of a strategy to win sanctions relief and other concessions. South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. typically confirm North Korean ballistic missile launches, but did not immediately do so for the latest launch on Thursday. It's 6:35. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Montgomery County, on the outer loop of the Beltway, there is a crash. Three right lanes are blocked approaching New Hampshire Avenue, jamming traffic back to the 95 interchange. If you're traveling between the two beltways, on 95, all lanes are clear, northbound and southbound. But on the BW Parkway, northbound, there is a crash right near Powder Mill Road. In D.C., 295, 395, and 695, no construction and no crashes. And on the Virginia side of the beltway, inner loop and outer loop are at the posted speed limit. I'm not seeing any crashes, and I have no reports of any construction. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Well, after a delightful end to the week, we are expecting more nice conditions for this weekend. Today will be a little bit warmer. Highs in the upper 70s to near 80 degrees under mostly sunny skies. Now, later on tonight, lows back in the 50s across the region. Some increasing clouds as we head towards your Sunday. We're expecting rain chances to be minimal. Best chance in the mountains and the Appalachians. I think the D.C. Metro will be dry. High temperatures tomorrow in the low and mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
51 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:36, the Saturday Morning Update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday Morning Update continues, and we've got Jennifer Harper joining us. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
You know, we talk often about the political divide in the country, and you know, you say to yourself, can it get any worse? What are your professionals saying?
Well, you know, Rick, we really have talked a lot about the divides between Democrats and Republicans over the years. But, yes, things have gotten worse. And I've got some information today from the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. You might have heard of them. That is master pollster and analyst Larry Sabato. He's the director of the center. And here's what he has to say about the divide between those who support Donald Trump and those who support President Biden. He says Trump and Biden voters are at a crisis stage. And he's revealing that the divide between Trump and Biden voters is deep, wide, and dangerous. The scope is unprecedented, and it will not be easily fixed. Again, this is coming from Larry Sabato this week from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And so just a couple of warnings that he says, illustrating the extent of the underlying divide nearly 90% of voters on both sides agree that people like them won't belong in America anymore if the, quote, other side has its way, and more than one in five say they agree completely that that is the case, meaning that the divide is there and there's not much we can do about it. It also found out that 52% of Republicans and 41% of Democrats agree that the situation in America is such that they would favor the proverbial red and blue states seceding from the Union to form their own country. This is serious. That's over half of Republicans and close to half of Democrats are beginning to agree with this. So kind of last but not least, he says that these positives, there are few positives that have come out in this poll, are offset by the fact that Biden and Trump voters do not see how working with the other side fits into a bigger picture or translates into benefits for them. So I kind of got chills when I read this, but just calling the divide deep, wide, and dangerous is enough for me.
Well, speaking of worsening, how about the president's poll numbers?
Yes, how about that? Well, there are a million of them seem to come out every week, but I particularly paid attention to some numbers that came out from ABC News this week, and it kind of is proof that President Biden's honeymoon is kind of down to its last nanoseconds, I think. According to ABC News, was conducted with the Ipsos pollster, they say, as President Joe Biden faces a critical moment for his agenda, Americans' confidence in his handling of a range of issues is eroding. And so we're just going to go right to the numbers. And this is, again, coming from ABC News. 66% of adults, U.S. adults, disapprove of the way President Biden is handling immigration and the border. 61% disapprove of the way he's handling Afghanistan. 60% disapprove of the way he's handling gun violence. 55% disapprove of the way he's handling crime in the United States. 48% disapprove of the way he's handling economic recovery. 44% disapprove of the way he's handling rebuilding the U.S. infrastructure. And last but not least, 42% also disapprove of the way President Biden is handling the response to the coronavirus. Again, this is coming from ABC. There's a poll conducted September 24th and 26th. So those are your crummy Biden numbers for today.
All right. Well, the president has problems, but the Republicans are having their own issues. What's going on and what do they do about it?
Well, sometimes some good advice comes out about very complicated situations that the politicians of all sides find themselves in. And this is coming from Stephen Cruiser. He's a senior columnist and associate editor of PJ Media. That's always a good site to check in if you haven't. And, yes, the President Biden's approval ratings are sinking. But Mr. Cruiser is saying that his message to the GOP is simply three words. Don't get cocky, he says. And Mr. Cruiser writes that Republicans are already starting to use this disaster of a presidency to taint the Democrats who are running next year. If the election were this year, Democrats would have to run screaming from Biden's record to have any hope of winning at all. There is no reasonable expectation that anything this president and his puppet masters do will ever get better. The Democrats' fortunes aren't going to dramatically improve by this time next year. The danger for Republicans right now is overconfidence. The party and its 2022 candidates can't get lazy and start assuming victory. They also have to keep an eye on what kind of election shenanigans the Democrats are undoubtedly going to try and get away with in the name of COVID next year. There's a golden opportunity for the Republican Party to have a big year in 2022, but everybody involved needs to remain focused and hope the country survives the Biden wrecking ball. And, you know, just great advice there. Keep your eye on the mission and don't get cocky. Again, that's coming from Stephen Cruiser over at PJ Media.
A lot of people ask, who's running the country? And some people say the former President Barack Obama is running the country, but he's not only running the country, he's running up the bill.
That's a pretty good way to put it. In case you didn't notice, the brand new Obama Presidential Center, that is the name of former President Obama's, should be presidential library, but it's called the Obama Presidential Center. They broke ground on this enormous project in Chicago. I've just got some numbers for you this morning. This is a 19-acre complex, Rick. It's going to include research facilities, a museum, archives, along with a sledding hill, a recording studio, and a gym. Both Mr. Obama and Michelle Obama are describing this new facility as a university for activism and social change and a global hub. But anyway, the biggest number here is how much this thing is costing, and the final cost on it is $830 million. That's according to an Associated Press analysis of the documents that have been released by the Obama Foundation in recent days. If you're curious about all of this, I just want to see what $830 million will buy you in Chicago, simply go to Obama.org and take a peek. This is what's coming.
In spite of the pushback on cancel culture, how is cancel culture doing on the college campus?
Yeah, well, maybe there ought to be a little bit more pushback against that cancel culture, because apparently all of the politically correct behaviors and the whole cancel culture thing is so rampant on U.S. colleges and universities these days that there is now an interactive database out there tracking the whole phenomenon. If you're curious about what's going on there, the College Fix, this is a news organization that is actually written by students from all over the nation, who are sort of right-minded, right-side-minded. Anyway, they are have compiled a huge compendium of all the book burnings, censorship, renamed buildings, harassed guest speakers, fired professors, among the many examples. And again, this is coming from the College Fix. If you're curious about this, it's an interactive thing, very easy to use. Just go to thecollegefix.com. Particularly interesting for parents who've got kids in college these days.
So the Fox News Channel is celebrating its 25th and celebrating on top, eh?
Oh, yes. They still rule all the cable news ratings, as they have for, I think, coming up on 20 years, besting the competition. But also, they're also acing the ratings when they're going against such networks as CBS, NBC, ABC, et cetera. But Fox News is turning 25 years old on October 7th. They were founded on October 7, 1996, and they're going to have a big one-hour special on this tomorrow, Sunday, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. They're bringing out the network's most tenured employees and some of the big stars. Brett Baer, Steve Doocy, Lauren Green, Jennifer Griffin, Sean Hannity are among those who will appear. And also Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, Greg Gutfeld, who's getting great ratings as a comedian, Jeanine Perreault are just a few of them coming up tomorrow. And they're also going to be rolling out a whole bunch of short-form vignettes from people that you haven't seen for a while on the network, talking about their anniversary. And this is including celebrities, the network favorites, regular personalities. Even now, former President George W. Bush is going to be among those offering the commentary. If you're curious about all that, go to foxnews.com. And there's a section called Fox News 25, and you can see all these short-form vignettes. I believe starting tomorrow, but anyway, happy anniversary to Fox. 25 years and great ratings still.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. As always, thank you very much, and you can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Have a good weekend, everybody.
6:46, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us. Al B. D. is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
Starting with the Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland, you can go completely around the district and not even hit your brakes. Use your cruise control. On the inner loop and on the outer loop, no delays. If you're traveling between the two Beltways in Prince George's County, on the BW Parkway and on 95, northbound and southbound lanes are at the posted speed limit. In Prince George's County, on Route 50 between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, all lanes are clear east and west. And in Montgomery County on 270, between the Beltway and Frederick, you're not going to tap the brakes on the northbound side or even on the southbound side. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Well, after a delightful end to the week, we are expecting more nice conditions for this weekend. Today will be a little bit warmer, highs in the upper 70s to near 80 degrees under mostly sunny skies. Now, later on tonight, lows back in the 50s across the region. Some increasing clouds as we head towards your Sunday. We're expecting rain chances to be minimal. Best chance in the mountains and the Appalachians. I think the D.C. Metro will be dry. High temperatures tomorrow in the low and mid 80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
51 degrees in the nation's capital, 647, Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update. It is good to have you with us, and it is always great to have Jim Trusty with us. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. He is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
The Brian Laundrie case, the manhunt continues, and a lot of questions swirling around his family. Reports out on Friday that Brian Laundrie saw his sister, Cassie Laundrie, the day that he returned from the camping trip, and then another time in that first week that he was back. And this is according to the Laundrie family's attorney. So there's the interaction with the sister. A lot of questions about the parents. They went on a camping trip with Brian when Gabby is missing. I mean, a lot of people are kind of wondering about that one. What do you make of this? And then I want to ask you if you've ever seen anything like this before in your experience. But what do you make of where we are now in this?
Sure. Well, it's a very difficult area because, you know, it's not surprising that families will have loyalty towards their son. Or their brother, and that they will, you know, wish the best even under the worst circumstances of potential criminality. But law enforcement doesn't tolerate a lot of shenanigans when it comes to family protection. So they're really in a situation where they're walking up to a line of obstruction, of false statements, of harboring a fugitive or aiding and abetting flight from prosecution. I mean, there's a lot of state or federal charges that can apply when a family doesn't fully cooperate about the whereabouts of a fugitive.
Are those cases often prosecuted, or do the prosecutors ultimately look the other way if they get the suspect?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's really no perfect answer because it certainly varies. But I can tell you, I've certainly seen a number of situations firsthand in federal court in particular where family members trying to help out their sons, brothers, husbands, in fairly low-grade circumstances, not even like a murder case, would end up being charged themselves. So there is prosecutorial discretion, but if they feel like they're getting a real, you know, thumb in the eye from the family about finding this young man, it would not surprise me if charges followed.
As a prosecutor at the U.S. Department of Justice, have you had personal one-on-one experience in a case like this?
Well, actually, it goes back to before then when I was a state prosecutor. I had a case involving a guy named Samuel Sheinbein who took part in a murder in Montgomery County, Maryland, and fled to Israel. And the key part of that flight was that his parents made a conscious decision knowing that he was wanted for the murder of Freddie Teo. They had already gotten him up to New York, and when they met with him in New York, they gave him a bunch of cash and plane tickets and sent him on his way to Israel, where he would actually fight extradition successfully. So it made a big difference in terms of what was going to happen to his case, and it led to the state's attorney's office issuing a warrant for his father for obstructing justice and for harboring a fugitive. So it definitely happens, and you know, again, it's a matter of how flagrant the behavior is that probably determines whether a prosecutor tries to pursue it.
I want to turn to another family case, this one in South Carolina. It's been in the news. Alex Murdaugh, the attorney, his younger son and his wife killed in June. He found them at the family kennel. He's been named a person of interest, but fully alibied. The death of his housekeeper, and that's suspicious. What is the latest? And give us a little more background than that on this one.
Sure. I mean, this is an incredible story, and I think, you know, as a lawyer who's been in the criminal justice realm for a good number of years, if I started hearing this story on a TV show, I'd say this is not realistic. It is crazy. But it starts with the Murdaugh family being a very established family in the law in what they call the Lowcountry of South Carolina, which is primarily basically five different counties in that part of the state. And the Murdaugh family goes back like 100 years having pretty much control over the solicitor's offices, the prosecutors within those particular counties. And Alex Murdaugh, the family patriarch of current day, in fact, it was until recently a part-time prosecutor, which they allow in some rural jurisdictions to do a little bit of private practice and a little bit of public. So the story gets crazy real recently. I mean, it started in June when Alex was the one that found his younger son and his wife at the family kennels. He was perfectly alibied. And just a quick footnote, sometimes people seem to go out of their way to have a good alibi. So the fact that he couldn't physically have been at the kennels at the time certainly eliminates him from being a trigger man, but doesn't eliminate him from complicity. As it turns out, at the time that his son Paul was killed, he had a pending manslaughter case based on his apparent drunken operation of a boat, which killed his girlfriend when it slammed into a pier. You also had the situation where the family housekeeper had apparently fallen downstairs to her death in the house, and there was no autopsy, which was already strange, and people began to wonder were there some strings that were pulled in this thing where a medical examiner characterized it as an accidental death. Well, the crazy wrinkle to that story is there was a wrongful death case filed against Alex and settled for the tune of about $500,000. That money went to, of all people, one of Alex's best friends, who was the lawyer representing the housekeeper's estate. And whatever happened with that money, it's never made its way to the actual victim's family. So there's a brewing controversy now about whether Murdoch and that other attorney might have come up with their own side deal to resolve that wrongful death case that had nothing to do with the victims actually being compensated. So there's all sorts of mayhem and homicides. And about a month ago, Alex was taking a circuitous route to Charleston when he claimed to be ambushed and shot in the head by a perfect stranger. Well, the perfect stranger turned out to be a former client who he had enlisted to stage a shooting for the purposes of collecting insurance money. So,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is getting really good.
Rick, if I read this in a book by about the second chapter, I say this is completely unrealistic. Nobody lives this life. But in the Murdoch household, it seems to be just complete mayhem. Well, Alex has now been fired from the firm at which he was a named partner for misappropriation of funds. He has checked himself into rehab, claiming he has a serious drug problem that kind of explains everything. But meanwhile, I have to guess he's really probably sweating whether his friend, the former client who staged that shooting, has more to say about Alex Murdoch and his family and the deaths in his family than just what happened out there on the rural road on the way to Charleston. So this case is absolutely bonkers. There's going to be more and more coming out. The investigators have also reopened a previous fatal hit-and-run vehicular accident that apparently involved the Murdoch family. And the solicitor, the prosecutor on that case, recused himself. So there's so much going on underneath the surface that we can't quite figure out yet. We just know there's a lot of mayhem that they're looking at, and it's definitely a story to stay tuned to.
So when the friend shot him, it just grazed his head, right?
Yeah, superficial wound to the head. And the initial story was that he had car troubles and that a pickup truck drove by in the middle of the afternoon, turned around and just shot at him. And, I don't know what people's stereotypes of rural South Carolina are, but I don't subscribe to the thought, and I didn't when it first happened, that random strangers seeing you fix a tire are just going to take a shot at your head. So the whole thing, including the timing, seemed really odd. And as it's played out, Alex Murdoch is currently charged for that insurance fraud, although not in jail.
Well, the friend can't shoot straight and the Murdochs can't drive straight, so we'll see where this one goes. Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. As always, Jim, thank you so very much.
Sure, thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too, and you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. 6:57, this is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. John Gizzi coming up, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and K.T. McFarland, and she's got an amazing opinion piece, so we'll be talking about that. Stick around. Love about politicians. You ready for this? U.S. Senator Dick Durbin said yesterday that he recently became the latest Democrat to have a too-close-for-comfort experience with urban crime. His ordeal was last weekend, and it prompted David Axelrod, a former top advisor to President Obama, to call on Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot to declare a public safety emergency. How many children, teenagers, adults have been shot and killed in Chicago over the past 5 years, and nobody seems to care. But Dick Durbin is within 100 feet of some gunshots going off or something, and now David Axelrod, the Obama advisor, comes in and says, oh, we need to declare a public safety emergency. It's just like they're all wanting to defund the police while they live in gated communities surrounded by their own personal security. The hypocrisy is unbelievable. So David Axelrod, you got to be kidding me. What about all the people that got killed? Are you kidding me? I'm sorry, but that's just, the hypocrisy is mind-boggling. We're coming up on the 7 o'clock news. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media station.